lot of places, and you don't know what your future holds.
Well, and then you saw it when you saw these bodies floating around in the ocean there when you we were making the rendezvous with the PT boats for making the landing. You saw those bodies floating around, and you couldn't help but think it'd be you in a little bit, you know. And those thoughts weren't very comforting, but the thing is there, what could you do about it, you know?
How did you process that? What maybe helped you get through those moments or made you put that in perspective?
Well, it was just the fruitlessness. In other words, there was nothing else you could put up with.
Wasn't going to do you any good to dwell on
it. No, huh? You couldn't dwell on it. And while we were going into the landing of the island there, why, the lieutenant, I was had my sunglasses on, and I was smoking a pipe, you know, and he says, "Cowles, what the heck do you think you're doing, going on a picnic?" And I says, "If I'm going to die, I'm going to die happy. That's the odds to it, you know."
Well, there you ended up in a battle, and for those of you at home that don't know, a common practice in the Pacific at this point in the war is 1944 was drawing on. Got to the fall of 1944, most of the amphibious landings, you'd have the Marines go in first to do the initial fighting, and then the Army would come in with reinforcements, cleanup duty, and so have it. But you mentioned Peleliu, and we've had veterans on this show that were involved in that battle. When you take the total number of men involved and then calculate the casualties that happened in that battle, that has the highest casualty rate of any battle in the Pacific, yet it's often a forgotten battle. People talk about Iwo Jima, they talk about Okinawa. Not that much is out there about Peleliu. There have been some good books written, but how would you describe that scene for those listening at home who weren't there in September, October 1944? What was that like?
Well, on Peleliu, why, the Marines, like you said, were the ones that had the object of taking the island and more or less trying to secure it, you know. And, of course, if you looked on the island itself when we got there, of course, a lot of the battlements were disposed of, and you know, through the Marine Corps. And they had... If you would have seen, they had what they call Radar Hill, which had radio-controlled howitzers that protected the island from ships and stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And then if you'd have seen them, all that armament that they had there, they were well protected. And plus the fact that that island had been... a mining by the Germans for fertilizer before World War I, and the Japanese got that for their participation in securing World War I, you know. So they were given that island, and on that island, because of the mining and stuff, it was just a mine island of hills. Mm-hmm. Or they weren't what I call mountains, but they were hilly. It was all hilly, and it was all limestone. And they were 3 and 4 stories deep that they had time to prepare those emplacements and stuff.
Well, like so many of the stories you hear about places like Iwo Jima and Okinawa, it was a lot more than met the eye. These weren't guys standing on top of hilltops and welcoming you on the beach. They were dug in. They were in tunnels. They were hiding. And I imagine for someone going into that, and granted, as you said, the Marines had been there first. It was a little calmer when you got there than it was initially. But I can imagine that you have to be on guard 24 hours a day because you never know when someone's going to come out of hiding and ambush you.
Well, you could actually hear them through the limestone, you know, that was...
The
in
tunnels.
The tunnels, you could actually hear them. And it was kind of scary. You didn't know when they were going to come out, you know. And they had it all lined up so that they had good fields of fire, you know, to protect their interests. And the worst part was Bloody Nose Ridge, you know, which the, it was a hill that had a big tree on it, right at the tip of it. And the bombing and everything tried to dig it out, but it was a hollow tree, and it was an observation point for the enemy to see all our movements and stuff and concentrate the fire, you know, on anybody that was trying to take the hills. And so they would let you get into the clearings. There was the other tree on the hill. Just if you wanted to take it a forward position, why, you just had a clear feel of having to run up that hill. But when you got up to a certain point, they opened fire. They had it all crossed by.
There wasn't a whole lot to hide behind.
There was nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. No rocks or nothing.
And just to put a little perspective on it for our listeners, the Japanese, as far as anyone can tell looking back, the Japanese had approximately 11,000 men on the island to start with. 10,695 of those 11,000 were killed. On the American side, the Marines sent over 17,000. There are about 11,000 from the 81st Infantry Division. Between the Marines and the Army, almost 10,000 were either wounded or killed. Almost 10,000 casualties with just under 1,800 killed. You were one of more than 8,000 to be wounded. Tell us the story, at least begin to tell us the story of the day when you were wounded and how that came about. You described for us that there wasn't anything to hide behind. I imagine that was the case on that day.
Well, the thing of it was, they tried to take this observation point out. And they could overrun it, but they could not succeed in holding them down because it was all, in other words, where they had caverns underneath. And
so your guys were trying to take it out.
Well, they did take it out, but a lot of times, but then they'd move over it, but they would go back into them because they were all interconnected by caves.
Right. It was just pretty hard to hold on to just...
Well, you could shoot at them all day, but not hit them because you were hitting the hillsides, you know. Well, so they tried to take that. Well, every day they made an assault on that position.
Had you been there before, or was this the first time for you?
Well, it was the first time for me. And then when it come our turn to take it, we got the orders from the General Holland Smith, who was on a battleship out in the Pacific there, and he was in charge of the Marine Corps for the operation of the island there, but the Army was to back him up, you know.
Right, right.
So they put out the order that they had to take it at all costs, you know. So every day they put a new regiment in there to try and take that position. That's why there were so many casualties.
Well, now we're going to need to catch another commercial break here, but what you said just struck me. When they say we need to take it at all costs, and you hear that, you say, wait a second, I might be the cost.
You go, yes, that's for sure.
Well,
and I didn't intend to be the cost.
But it did cost you something, and we're going to find out about that when Hometown Heroes continues. Francis Cowles of Kingsburg, our guest today. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ. You might recognize that as the work of the late, great Glenn Miller, or Major Glenn Miller, as some knew him in 1944. In fact, it would be December 15th, 1944, that a plane that Miller was flying in disappeared over the English Channel. He was never heard from again, but his music lives on, and we're happy each week to be able to play snippets of songs that were popular during the World War II era that our veterans remember. Francis Cowles certainly remembered that song, and he definitely remembers what was happening on the Pacific island of Peleliu in October of 1944. We picked that back up now, and let's go specifically to October 22nd, 1944, the day before you were wounded. You're part of a 12-man squad that is asked to take this position on Bloody Nose Ridge. The Japanese have an outpost at the top of this hill. a hollowed-out tree that they're using as an observation post. And you're part of a 12-man squad that's tasked to go up there and take it. You're the assistant to the BAR, Browning Automatic Rifleman, carrying ammunition for him. But I understand at one point you were standing behind a rock taking cover, saying some prayers.
That's right.
I imagine you said a lot of prayers while you were over there.
Well, I figured it was the last because everybody that tried to take that position didn't come back, you know.
So you're sitting there talking to God, and someone starts talking to you. Tell me about that.
Well, the lieutenant came, and he just come up to me, and he says, "Cowles, are you yellow?" And I says, "No, sir, I'm just saying my prayers." And as I said that, he got shot in the mouth.
Mm.
And I don't know the end results of that, but anyway, they wiped out the rest of the squad, you know, that was on the hillside. And then the company commander, my company commander, and lieutenant, the first sergeant,
uh-huh.
They were in their tent and they had a critique, and they, it was a I didn't know why they had a critique, but anyway, he wanted to appoint me as a squad leader for another squad to take up the next day.
Well, and one of the reasons for that was you're the only one left. 12 guys went out, the other 11 were killed?
Yeah, but he gave me another squad.
How did you survive that? How did you escape when the other 11 guys were killed?
Well, because I they opened fire just as I was talking to the lieutenant.
Right.
And that ended the
they picked
that
them all off at that moment.
Yes.
But because you were behind the rock.
Well, I was standing there talking to the lieutenant, you know.
Right, right.
And he got shot in the mouth, through the mouth, you know. And that ended the conversation and everything. I don't know whether he got killed or not. But anyway, that about an hour later, I was notified to report to the captain's tent, you know. They wanted a critique on this here.
Right. So that had been unsuccessful. You're the only one unharmed from that squad. They give you a new squad, you and 11 other guys, and say, tomorrow, October 23rd, 1944, you need to take this position. But this is something that's a little bit rare in the Army. They gave you some input here. They let you tell them how you thought you could take this point.
Well, no, I told them that I would not take it and follow their orders. I would take it under my terms.
And they responded well to that.
Huh? Yes.
Well, there's a new one.
Well, anyway, they asked me what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them instead of taking a frontal assault on a hill, we were going to go take it by the crest of the hill,
mm-hmm.
where I would have protection from the gunfire because it'd either go over my head or hit into the side of the hill. I was safe, you know, unless I exposed myself beyond the rocks, you know.
Because I guess first they said, we want you to take it, and you go the same way that they've been going, and you said,
yeah.
No, I'm not going to do that?
That's right. That's what I told them.
Because you felt you'd just be leading these soldiers into their deaths.
That's what I told them. I didn't figure out if I wanted to be a goat to lead sleepless slaughter. A lot of times I had talked to the commander, you know, and when they asked for volunteers and nobody would take the volunteers, and then he would give me the volunteer job, but then he would give me permission to do it the way I thought I could do it, not the way that the Army says you had to do it.
So you told them, I'm not going to lead these sheep to the slaughter. We're going to go this way with the crest. They said, okay, go for it.
And we followed it up. I says, don't change the regiment of making believe we're going to make the assault. Follow the same procedure as you always do, you know, and make believe we're going to make another assault, only we're going to be coming up the crest of the hill this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, we'll have a satchel charge, which we can drop down into this observation point there,
mm-hmm.
and so that they can't get up there to give directions to their troops. And that's what we did. And of course, they had to have a little time to crawl back up, you know, because they were down undercover there so that they wouldn't get wounded, you know, from the artillery shells and everything that they were using to try and penetrate that observation point.
So the long and short of it is your plan worked.
It
would,
did.
Would you say that you caught the Japanese by surprise, that they were unprepared for?
Well, in other words, how many times did they try it? In other words, we were doing the same thing every day.
So they
never were expecting anything different.
Mm-hmm. So you caught them by surprise. You dropped the charges down this hollowed out tree on top of the hill. That's their observation post.
They didn't have no observation anymore. See.
So you had taken that position.
Yes.
And you're feeling pretty good.
Yes, but I says, we ain't going to hold this very easy, you know. I said, they're going to get this tonight.
Because that was an important spot. That's high
ground. Well, that was the only thing they had left.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing they had left.
Yeah, this is getting on. That battle had started September 15th, so you're more than a month after it began, October 23rd. But I understand that night.
They come, you know, about 2 o'clock in the morning
mm-hmm.
to try and retake the position. But because of the loose rock, which they was on the side of the hill, which they hollowed out from their caves,
mm-hmm.
you know, was loose. And anybody stepping on that would slide a little bit, and you'd hear them coming, you know.
So that's what woke you up at 2 in the morning?
Yeah.
Or gunfire?
Well, no, that's what woke me up. And then they called for flares.
Mm-hmm. To light up the sky.
They'd lit the flares up, and then right from here, a little further than the door away from me, was this Japanese standing by a tree, just froze.
It's about 20 feet away.
Yeah.
So that the sky lights up, and you see a Japanese soldier 20 feet away.
Yeah, but he froze.
Mm-hmm.
They were told not to move when you have light, because you're a target then.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to give away my position where I was hid, you
mm-hmm.
know, because I had a rocked embankment around my position. And I figured if I missed him, he'd know where I was.
So kind of weapon did you have?
I had a M1.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had a .45, which I had taken out of a tank that was disabled.
So you had a rifle and a pistol.
And a .45.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want him to let him know where my position was, so I didn't fire while the flare was up. I was waiting for the flare to dim down and go down, and then at that moment I would fire. And I fired, and he just disappeared
mm-hmm.
down the hill. And that was all hell broke loose with rocket or 4.2 millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I guess, one of the boys had called for assistance because of the Japs trying to take over the position.
Right.
Some of the mortar shells exploded up in the air. And I had an old grenade box it was made of oak wood. Mm-hmm. It took two people to carry, you know, with these grenades. And I just put it over my chest, you know, to protect myself. And the minute I got it over there, that old shrapnel just stuck into that wood there.
And so you knew that these shells were coming.
You couldn't help it, because they were exploding above the ground, and the shrapnel was just going all over.
So you said to yourself, I've got to get something to protect myself. You grab this grenade box, throw it over your chest, and all of a sudden, rat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah, yeah. That's when I got wounded. And then
where did it get you?
It got me in the hands. I was holding it, you know.
But if you didn't have that grenade box, it would have gotten
that.
Your hands and your heart and everything
yeah.
else.
So anyway, the company commander, he called up there And he says, do you need a medic, you know? And I says, don't send anybody up. I says, it's hell up here, you know? I says, I'll make it through, you know, till morning, you know, and then I'll go down and get
treated. So you got patched up the next morning?
Yeah.
You ever think about what would have happened if that grenade box wasn't there?
I don't know why. See, we carried that thing up there. That was what we were using for dropping down. After the satchel charges went off, then we were using grenades to drop it on every few minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good thing you took it up there.
Sure it was.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me.
That's right.
Well, and that wasn't the end of the close calls for Francis Calls. Those shrapnel wounds in his hands would earn him a Purple Heart. A Purple Heart he still has today, of course. And we'll ask him when we come back what that means to him. And also, hopefully, have time to hear about some of the other close calls he experienced before the war was over. World War II Army veteran Francis Cowles of Kingsburg, our guest today. We'll be right back as Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remember, if you have a veteran that you think I ought to catch up with and have as a guest on the program, you can email me those suggestions, paul@kmj580.com. We honor the 226th anniversary of the Purple Heart Medal this week by having a Purple Heart recipient as our guest on the show. That's Francis Cowles, 87 years old from Kingsburg. He earned that Purple Heart October 23rd of 1944 when he was wounded. He picked up that grenade box, as you heard him describe, covered his chest. Otherwise, the shrapnel would have taken him out completely. He wouldn't be here talking to us. But because he had that grenade box, which absorbed much of the shrapnel, only his hands were wounded, and you got treatment the next day. How long did this injury keep you out of commission, and what did that feel like? I mean, on one hand, I'm sure you're glad that that box worked. On the other hand, your hands are hurting, right?
Yeah, but they didn't keep me out of commission very long. I just went to the infirmary, and then they took care of me, you know, and it healed by itself, you know.
So you were back in action pretty shortly thereafter.
Oh, yes.
Back trying to survive this bloody battle on the island of Peleliu in the Pacific. And by the time the war was over, you would move around in the Pacific some more. You'd have some R&R. You'd also be preparing for the invasion of mainland Japan. If they
right.
hadn't dropped those bombs, we recognized that anniversary last week. If they hadn't dropped those bombs, you would have participated in the invasion of Japan. So I'm sure you're thankful that that played out the way it did. But you still had action there in late 1944 on Peleliu. And in fact, that same area, Bloody Nose Ridge, which had given you some bloody fingers, but not taken your life, you'd be asked to go reinforce and take over. You had the position. The Americans had the position. You think there's not a whole lot to worry about. You're just going up the hill to take over for the guys who are there. But that's not exactly how it happened. Tell us about this day when something caught your eye on the way up Bloody Nose Ridge.
Well, like in the service, they always relieved the troops, you know, so that they could get away from the action. And there wasn't any particular thing to fear because I figured we had taken the opposition out, and I was just going up the hill the normal way that they were making all these frontal assaults. And as I was going up there, I was in the crouched position just in case that things were... Well, I always walk with a crouch going uphill in a way, you know.
Well, especially when you describe this island, like so many islands in the Pacific, a network of tunnels, you never know where they're hiding, so.
Yeah. So, anyway, as I was walking up, I happened to spot a shiny object that took my eye, you know, and I thought, well, I bent down to pick it up, and just as I bent down to pick it up, the machine gun opened fire, you know. So I stayed down and crawled the rest of the way, you know, so that I wouldn't be hit. And I was just lucky to have spotted that item. I don't know how it got there.
So Abe Lincoln saved your life.
Yeah, you might say so.
Yeah. So if you ever met the soldier who dropped that penny on Bloody Nose Ridge, you'd say, thanks a lot. You saved my life.
Yeah.
And so if the folks at home didn't get that picture, here he is walking up the hill. crouched position, sees a shiny penny on the ground, reaches to pick it up, and at that exact moment, here comes the machine gun fire. If you hadn't bent over to pick up that penny, again, you're a goner. How do you explain that?
I don't. I just figured the good Lord took care of me many, many, many times, because I had grenades go roll right at my feet and not go off. I had rifle shells take my helmet off of my head, you know, but not scar me. I was just blessed. I just felt blessed. That's all.
Well, and as is the case with so many of us in this country, so many of us wouldn't be here if our fathers or grandfathers had not survived the war. That's the case for me. If my grandpa hadn't come home from Europe, there are four children that never would have been born if you hadn't survived all those close calls there on Peleliu and in the Pacific. And I understand that there was a situation, too, and you described when the flare went off and there was a Japanese soldier that you had to shoot, otherwise he would have killed you. There was another situation where you chose not to follow the typical order to shoot on sight, but to take a Japanese soldier captive. Describe that for us, if you can.
Well, in those days, we always had a certain area that we had to patrol, you know, because of the closeness of the other islands to the island of Peleliu. And when the tide went out, they could wade from one island to the other, you know, and that way they would replenish their forces, you know. And, of course, this one day I was going through the area where I always patrolled, and there was this soldier laying there, but he didn't look like he was dead to me. And so I just prodded him with my end of my rifle, you know, and I saw his eyes wink a little bit, and I just took him. I didn't shoot at him or anything. All I did was just motion for him to get up. And then I, at the same time, I put him in a, there was greyhounds dogs on the island, you know, and there was dog kennels down in the area where I was patrolling. So I put two of them end for end together and then put him in that, you know, and fed him, and the rest of the soldiers made a pet out of him, you know, by giving him a lot of gum and old goodies that they had, you know. And then I had him for about 3 days and 4 days. And then the officers from headquarters wanted him, you know, to talk to the people that were still on the islands to see if they'd give up, you know. And that's the last I heard of him, you know.
Well, and especially in the Battle of Peleliu, that was very rare, because if you look back at the history, there were almost 11,000 killed. There were only 11,000 on the island, and the statistics that I've seen show only 200 were ever taken captive there, because they were fighting to the death.
Yeah.
So you spared his life, and who knows what went on in his life as the rest of the war raged on. I want to ask you, I mentioned that you have the Purple Heart. You earned it for the shrapnel wounds in your hand. Has that meant something to you over the years, to be part of that fraternity of men who have been wounded and serving our country, and to know that for 226 years Americans have received that medal? Does that mean something to you?
I really never gave it much thought, you know what I mean? I just figured that's part of life, you know? And of course, I appreciate the fact that they awarded me the Purple Heart, because it helped me through many a tough time.
Well, and I'm thankful that you received your Purple Heart while you were alive. So many families received Purple Hearts on behalf of the soldiers who were killed. 400,000 were killed during World War II. I'm very thankful that you made it home. Thank you for serving our country and for being here to talk about it today. We've got a little more than a minute left in the program. Is there anything that you would say to the listeners, maybe who aren't of your generation, maybe who are younger and don't really understand what you were doing, what guys like you were doing in World War II? What's the greatest significance of it in your mind? Why was it important to do what you did?
Well, it was to fight for a freedom that is not universal, it's quite a privilege, you know. And I also received the Bronze Star, too, as a reward for the action on Pelton.
On Bloody Nose Ridge. Mm-hmm. On taking that position the first time.
Yeah.
Well, well deserved. And that is an even more elite fraternity of those who have received the Bronze Star. And the way you described it, I can see why you earned it, because that certainly took some bravery and valor and courage to do it the way you did, and to tell the superior officers you wanted to do it your way. I haven't heard too many guys that got away with that.
Oh, they were open to suggestions.
I'm glad they were.
Oh,
we're running out of time here. We've only got about 10 seconds left. So I just, again, want to say thank you for serving our country, for being here today, and I hope that all your friends will do the same, and thank you. Francis Cowles of Kingsburg, our guest today. Next week, we'll be back with another program. If you missed part of this show, you can go online and hear the full version, KMJ580.com. That's Hometown Heroes Today. I'm Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.